We'd rather not get involved in a lawsuit, but that's his right as well as any other citizen's right.
A potential legal fight over paying this year's permanent fund dividend. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, August 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the impacts of cleaning up homeless camps in Anchorage.
Our neighbors who are camping are literally just neighbors who don't have a place to live. And if we had enough affordable housing in this community, that they would just be our neighbors.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski wants the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to defy Governor Bill Walker's veto that cuts this year's dividends in half. If the veto stands, Willikowski says he's likely to sue to force the state to fully pay permanent fund dividends this fall. Andrew Kitchenman of APRN and KTOO in Juneau reports.
Senator Willikowski says Walker didn't have the authority to veto PFD funds. In a letter sent Wednesday to Permanent Fund Corporation Chief Executive Officer Angela Rodell, Willikowski cites a state law that says the corporation shall transfer an amount set by a formula for dividends.
You just simply can't veto a statute, regardless of what appropriation is made or not.
If it stands, Walker's veto will reduce the dividend from what was projected to be slightly more than $2,000 per person to $1,000. Walker said he took the step to prevent the state from exhausting all permanent fund earnings in the next 2 years, and that the veto would actually preserve PFDs into the future. Willikowski cites a 1994 Alaska Supreme Court decision that says permanent fund earnings go directly into the earnings reserve account. From there, state law says half of the annual deposit is distributed in PFDs.
They very clearly said this is an automatic transfer. So I think the case law is clear. The interpretation of the statute is clear. The statute is clear. And they've got an obligation to transfer the full funds.
A permanent fund spokeswoman referred questions to the State Department of Law. Department spokeswoman Corey Mills says the state constitution requires that all state spending, including dividends, is subject to the governor's veto.
It's been the Department of Law's longstanding opinion that dividends do require an appropriation, just as, you know, any other money that's spent in the state. And that's because of the Constitution's requirement for that the legislature appropriates money. The governor then has the line item veto power.
Mills added that the 1994 Supreme Court case didn't focus on permanent fund dividends. Willikowski says that if the Permanent Fund Corporation doesn't agree to transfer the full amount, he and others would likely sue over it.
I think there's a high likelihood it'll happen. I'm not going to say that with 100% certainty, but I'll just say there's a high likelihood that there will be a lawsuit.
Mills says the administration is prepared to defend its position and the Permanent Fund Corporation's position to only transfer what was provided after Walker's veto.
We'd rather not get involved in a lawsuit, but that's his right as well as any other citizen's right.
Dividends are scheduled to be distributed on October 6th. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Two Democrats are running for Lisa Murkowski's U.S. Senate seat. Both men are the same age. They're running low or no budget campaigns. Both used to be Republicans. And right there, the similarities come to a dead stop. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports on two candidates who, by disposition, are polar opposites.
Edgar Blatchford is 65, and it's hard to imagine a more boyish senior citizen. He's got the slight build of a long-distance runner, and he comes across as guileless. When Blatchford wants to point out a harsh truth, he'll sometimes preface it with a good golly.
I think I'm beginning to realize more and more why I am running. It's like, I feel good about it. I feel good about putting my name on the ballot and saying, I'd like to be a U.S. Senator.
He's got political credentials. He was mayor of Seward. He served in the cabinets of two Alaska governors. He was CEO of Chugach, the native corporation of Prince William Sound. He also founded a chain of rural newspapers. Now he teaches journalism and public policy at the University of Alaska. Still, Blatchford is running an unconventional shoestring campaign.
What I found out, it's incredibly difficult to raise money to go in against an incumbent. Most people, I think, are intimidated. They don't want to say anything. You know, they'll pat you on the back and say, good luck. We wish you well, Edgar.
He says he did speak to the state Democratic Party before he filed, and a committee coalesced urging him to run for U.S. House. He decided, though, that Murkowski needed a Democratic challenger.
And I lost half my committee, which is okay. You know, I understand.
Many of the state's frequent Democratic donors are supporting independent Margaret Stock. Blatchford, who describes himself as a big fan of Hillary Clinton, says party affiliation matters.
This is not the time to abandon Democratic values and try to develop relationships with people who aren't totally reflective of Democratic values.
Blatchford has a thing for education. You'll need two hands to count his college degrees, a BA from Alaska Methodist University, law degree from University of Washington, master's in journalism from Columbia, an MA from Dartmouth, another MA from Harvard's Kennedy School, and a PhD from UAF. Among his priorities are to improve corporate governance. Blatchford says native corporations need more transparency and equality for shareholders. And maybe those changes will help Wall Street, too. The other Democrat on the primary ballot is Ray Metcalf, a former legislator from Anchorage. Metcalf calls himself the anti-corruption candidate. He has, for decades, distributed reams of documents detailing what he considers to be Alaska's dirty politics.
The dynamics of a corrupt state are such that it is the corrupt people who raise the money to put you in, so you'll give them more money so they can raise more money to put more people in.
Metcalf seems world-weary, like he's seen so much malfeasance that his outrage receptors have burned out and he's operating on muscle memory. His focus is the intersection of politics and midtown real estate development. Ride with him to an Anchorage coffee shop and he'll tell you where, as he sees it, political influence was bought and sold.
This is just the midsection of my three-hour tour of skullduggery, bribery, and how politicians launder money with real estate. And if you look at that...
He's not kidding about the tour. A few years back, he had a bus and took people around to show where the bodies are buried. Some of the scenarios Metcalf cites were the subject of political corruption investigations. Metcalf also connects dots in ways no authorities have verified. His targets say his accusations are false and over the top. As a state house legislator in the 70s and 80s, Metcalf was a Republican, but he feuded with the social conservatives. He founded his own party, the Republican Moderates. Then he went further to the left and became a Democrat. These days, he's into Bernie Sanders' ideas, including free tuition and single-payer health care.
You know, if you look at Bernie's slate, I'm in 100% agreement with everything I've ever seen him say.
Now, Metcalf feuds with the Democratic Party, which he says has mistreated the Sanders supporters.
We're still not welcome. They don't want us. They wish we would go away.
I get the feeling that you kind of like that status. That's a spot where you're comfortable being.
You're probably right.
One of these two candidates, Metcalf or Blatchford, will win the Democratic primary on Tuesday. He'll appear on the November ballot to challenge Senator Murkowski, assuming she wins her primary against two lesser-known Republicans, Bob Lochner and Thomas Lamb. Reporting from Anchorage, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what happened to the mammoths of St. Paul Island?
When you tell someone, like, you could have had a mammoth-drawn chariot if things had gone differently, you know, I think it makes them think a little bit differently about Ice Age ecology.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The primary election is August 16th. Polls are open at 7 a.m. till 8 p.m. You will be voting for United States Senator, United States Representative, State Senator, and State Representative. When you go to vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the list or you don't have ID, you may vote a question ballot. The question ballot updates your voter registration. If you need language or other assistance while voting, ask the election board or bring someone to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
The so-called Muskox Coalition, a group of House majority legislators, broke from majority leaders last year when they voted against using permanent fund earnings reserves to balance the state budget. Palmer's Republican incumbent Jim Culver stood with the coalition, and now party leaders are backing Culver's Republican challenger for his House 9 seat in next week's primary. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Two sites vital to national security, the TAPS terminal in Valdez and the Fort Greely missile base, bookend the House 9 district, which follows the Richardson Highway from Valdez to Delta Junction. Along the way, it winds through mountain passes, Alaska Native communities, truck stops, and barley farms. The sheer diversity of the district keeps Representative Jim Culver busy.
I am on the road a lot. I try to be there for them. Sometimes I'll do like a Skype town hall meeting if I can't be there.
Culver says he spends as much time as he can traveling his district in person.
And they told me, cut the budget first, and when you get the budget down, you know, then we can be supportive of some revenue going forward.
And he says his years on the Matanuska-Susitna Borough Assembly has given him plenty of experience with budget balancing. Culver is up for re-election this fall after his first term in the State House. But Republican Party leaders, fronted by new State Chair Tuckerman Babcock, want him out of the House 9 seat. The party is backing primary challenger George Rauscher. Why? To hear Culver tell it, it's because he voted with a faction of House Republicans to support Democrat opposition to a 2015 budget deal. Culver says the scheme would have taken $5 billion out of the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund, which pays for our dividends, and moved it to the corpus of the account. That would have triggered a state constitutional provision, which would have allowed the legislature access to the constitutional budget reserve with a simple majority vote. A number of legislators, Culver among them, were uncomfortable with doing that.
Pressure was building on us to cave and go with the leadership's plan to move the $5 billion. I had eight legislators scream at me for an hour that I had to be a team player and do this. And I'm like, there's no way that I'm going to mess with people's permanent fund.
Since then, Culver has butted heads with majority leadership in votes on a House oil tax credit bill and a move to put legislators on the Alaska Gas Line Development Board. Now party chair Babcock is on record as labeling Culver a Democrat masquerading as a Republican. In a letter to local newspapers, Babcock said he fears Culver may flip to the Democrats anytime, and this has thrown the Republican spotlight on primary challenger George Rauscher. Rauscher is benefiting from large campaign contributions linked to the Accountability Project, PAC, and to independent expenditure groups in Alaska. Rauscher, a contractor with 8 years on the Sutton Community Council, challenged Culver in the 2014 primary. Rauscher insists he's not a hitman for the Republicans. He says he was selected as a candidate because he better reflects conservative values than Culver does.
He's really not representing our district the way as conservative as we are.
Rauscher defends the hefty Republican Party contributions to his campaign, saying that he's just a working man with no fundraising capability. He points to Culver's generous union support.
I'm saying he's got a lot of special interest money. That's one thing that bothers me.
Rauscher says local issues are getting lost in the party infighting and points to his work on the community council on trails, bike paths, and library issues. He says more attention is needed to promote development, mineral, gas, or agriculture in his district.
And I don't see that happening. I don't see that happening with our legislators. I don't think that's happening with our current legislator in our district.
Culver says his legislative work has helped to develop Copper Basin hydro and gas exploration projects, although Culver downplays the concept of a House coalition, saying that four Bush Democrats routinely belong to the House Republican-led majority anyway. He will say the faction formed last year has had an impact this session on property tax legislation and an oil tax reform bill. And Culver says the Republican Party's strategy has actually given him a boost.
Since I've been under attack by the establishment, okay, the Alaskans are really coming to the table to, you know, ponying up their cash to support me.
For his part, Rauscher says the party's beef with Culver has overshadowed his race. The voters will decide who gets the Republican nod this time on August 16th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The municipality of Anchorage is cracking down on homeless camps and serving 15-day eviction notices. Until very recently, the push was leading to massive overcrowding at Brother Francis Shelter. Dozens of people were sleeping outside of the building when it maxed out at 240 guests. Those numbers have dropped in the past week, although it's not clear why. And coming from these short-term problems are some long-term solutions. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman, learn more.
Ignatius Tyson stands outside of Brother Francis Shelter in Anchorage with his girlfriend, putting clothes into a black garbage bag. They just received the items from the shelter's clothing room. Everything else they had was stolen from their campsite.
I know one day we left there to go eat at the soup kitchen, came back, and all the stuff was missing. Everything from our clothes, bikes, tents, everything got taken from us.
Tyson says he's not sure who took it all. The other camps around theirs weren't touched. And it felt horrible to have everything they owned taken away. Being at the credit shelter hasn't been perfect either. Someone stole their blankets and shoes from outside Brother Francis the night before. But ultimately, Tyson says maybe leaving the camp was a good thing.
I also look at that as a blessing, because we're out of the woods. We're not drinking and drugging anymore. We're sobering up. We're going to church more often.
Tyson says by going to church, he's made new connections with people at an employment center. That's where he's headed as soon as he stores his new clothes. Lisa Aquino, the director of Catholic Social Services, which runs the shelter, says it's those connections that will help people out of homelessness. And though the shelter was bursting at the seams for most of the summer, she says even more connections were built as community organizations and the municipality pitched in to help with the problem.
We've had just like people stepping forward and working together, and that's been, the problem solving has really been great.
ARP volunteers have helped sign seniors up for services. The municipality has put portable toilets outside BFS, and guests at the shelter are chipping in even more to make sure everything runs smoothly. BFS is also offering extra daytime services like laundry and showers, though they plan to do that even before the overcrowding started. Aquino says she's also seeing a shift in attitude among people at BFS toward getting permanent housing.
What's been exciting about right now is that people are talking about it now in terms of permanent housing. And I think the word's out there on the street, so I think more people are coming forward to ask for it.
And that's all part of the municipality's complicated long-term plan. Get people out of camps, out of shelters, and into homes. Nancy Burke is the municipality's homeless services coordinator. Since the beginning of the year, outreach workers and police have been collecting information from people at camps and shelters and meeting weekly to talk about ways to meet those individuals' needs. She says it makes it easier for juggling lots of complicated parts.
So it's this whole making the rental money match up with when the units are available and the social services. It's kind of three different worlds of connection that need to happen.
And when those connections do line up, she says it's helpful to be able to find people quickly, which means having folks go to shelters instead of moving from camp to camp. Burke says she knows that closing the camps caused unexpected stress at the shelters this summer, especially because many housing units are not available yet. But she says the municipality had to balance the needs of the entire community, People worry about public safety in areas with lots of camps. Walking down the Chester Creek Trail near downtown, she points to a small campsite with a few tents not far from the trail.
There are also homeowners that are just, you can see here, just adjacent to this area that have a hard time when someone's camping very close. It's threatening to them. And people feel that that just impacts their well-being.
Burke says some of the threats are real and some are just perceptions. The camps can be violent places, but you can't necessarily blame all petty crime on people who live there.
Our neighbors who are camping are literally just neighbors who don't have a place to live. And if we had enough affordable housing in this community, that they would just be our neighbors, you know.
Burke says 84 people who experienced homelessness were housed in the past year. Most of them had been chronically homeless. There are about 400 people left to go. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbaalaska.com. It's summer and time to get out on the water. Whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner, having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
Alaska State Troopers have arrested the driver of a van that crashed in the village of Atka in June, killing three people and injuring six others. 28-year-old Sonny Iloilo of Anchorage was taken into custody yesterday afternoon. He was arrested after being discharged from a local hospital where he had been receiving treatment for injuries related to the crash. In June, Iloilo was charged with multiple counts of manslaughter and assault and one count of driving under the influence. At the time of the crash, Iloilo was driving nine employees of Atka Pride Seafoods on a straight stretch of road toward the airport when the vehicle drifted off the roadway. Alaska State Troopers say he overcorrected, causing the vehicle to roll multiple times. No one in the van was wearing seatbelts. Troopers say the speed and impairment of the driver also contributed to the crash. Iloilo has been taken to jail in Anchorage. Bail is set at $250,000, and a third-party custodian will be required for his release. What killed the woolly mammoths on St. Paul Island? Thirst. For the first time, scientists have pinpointed the date 5,600 years ago and a likely cause of extinction. They believe the environmental changes that killed the animals mirror today's climate changes. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Zoe Sobel has more on the discovery.
6,000 years ago, St. Paul Island looked about the same, except for one big difference. There were mammoths, and it's not like they swam there. Penn State University's Russell Graham says they walked on the Bering Land Bridge.
As the glaciers melted, the water in the ocean started to rise, and in this process, a group of mammoths were isolated on the island.
For a while, it seemed like a good strategy for survival. Without predators, mammoths on St. Paul survived thousands of years longer than many other mammoths around the world. But eventually, they met their end. And Graham and a team of scientists wanted to know exactly when that happened.
We're able to actually pinpoint when the mammoths did go extinct. It wasn't like, well, we think at this time. We actually know.
Graham's team analyzed a sediment core from a lake on the island. They examined ancient DNA and three species of fungal spores that grow on the dung of large animals. All the evidence pointed to one culprit in the mammoth's extinction: not enough fresh water. As the sea level rose, St. Paul shrunk. Some lakes were lost to the ocean, and a more arid climate caused other freshwater sources to evaporate. As island dwellers, Graham says these mammoths were especially vulnerable.
A change in the climate of the magnitude that caused this extinction on the mainland probably would have been insignificant. But because the animals and plants are restricted to the island, and particularly smaller islands, this little change came together with a whole series of things to create a perfect storm that did cause the extinction.
And in the small world of paleoecology, the findings are a really big deal.
What's especially powerful about this study is that you have completely independent lines of evidence that all back up the same story.
That's University of Maine's Jacqueline Gill. As an ice age ecologist, she studies the past to put modern-day environmental problems like climate change in context. Since climate change and extinction have happened before, scientists can use what they know about various species' responses to help protect today's biodiversity. Some might say 6,000 years ago is ancient history, but in geological time, it isn't. While mammoths roamed St. Paul Island, Gill says ancient Egyptian civilization was well underway.
When you tell someone, like, you could have had a mammoth-drawn chariot if things had gone differently, you know, I think it makes them think a little bit differently about Ice Age ecology and how relevant this work is to the environmental problems we're facing right now.
The changing climate that claimed the mammoths of St. Paul has struck again, but this time it's human-driven. In June, a small Australian rodent became extinct, driving home Graham's point that island populations are extra vulnerable. And Graham says it's not just the rising sea levels that should concern islands and coastal communities. Take a look at Florida.
They may be looking out, you know, waiting for the water to come up and inundate the peninsula. But in reality, they maybe should be looking behind themselves because they're probably going to face other issues like freshwater availability before that actually happens.
The vulnerability of island populations is one lesson from the 72-foot-long sediment core. There could be more. Right now, scientists are hard at work analyzing the rest of it, all 18,000 years. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Zoe Sobel in Unalaska.
That report is from Alaska's Energy Desk, a new public media collaboration focused on energy and the environment. You can find more stories by visiting Alaska's Energy Desk on Facebook. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Liz Ruskin and Hillman and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Sarah Hansen and Zoe Sobel in Unalaska. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
If you've earned some college credits but haven't yet completed your degree, finish it now, online from anywhere. Online learning at University of Alaska Southeast provides courses in a format that is flexible for students working and raising families. Admission deadlines have been extended to August 19th. Apply now. Go to finishcollege.alaska.edu for more information. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.